This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 114. I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases and other related events. And every Thursday I release an episode called UFO Encounters, so please check them out. If you want to hear the extended version of this interview, please join the Patreon campaign. There are now more than 100 episodes in the back catalogue. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week I'm talking to Bruce Rapuanu about his book, Dominion Lost, A Scientist's Own Alien Abduction Encounters. Bruce has a BA degree where he majored in neurobiology and minored in psychology. He has a PhD in neuropharmacology and a Juris Doctor degree from New York Law School. He has had ET encounters throughout his life. Well, hi there. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Simon. It's a great opportunity and honor. It's an honor to be with you today.
So we'll talk about your book today. It's called Dominion Lost, A Scientist's Own Alien Abduction Encounters. This has been happening to you for a long time, hasn't it? But it's only now that you're writing this book. So why is it that you've chosen to do it at this time?
I had these experiences, a lot of strange experiences in my childhood that made, frankly, the greatest impression on me and my memory of the so-called normal experiences of mundane life. And I can never connect the dots and find out a way of integrating them into the rest of my life until the 80s, when there was an explosion of interest in this epiphenomenon of the UFO phenomenon known as alien abduction. And frankly, I was amazed how much I could connect all the dots, check all the boxes for the alien abduction, whether it was sighting a UFO in a close encounter situation, having episodes of missing time, waking up with a strange, diminutive, humanoid-like figure in the room, feeling I had episodes where I was flying, and then having strange scars. And going right down the list, I could check all the boxes, and I made the realization from reading the works of some of the most widely read UFO abduction investigators, especially the groundbreaking, pioneering Bud Hopkins, who coined the term missing time, David Jacobs, and of course the renowned Harvard psychiatrist, Dr. John Mack. I could come to no other conclusion. I could not find any other model for explaining my particular set of experiences other than the alien abduction model. But at that time, in the mid-80s, I was right in the middle of my biomedical research career. I had just obtained an NIH postdoctoral training grant at the top cancer hospital in the country. And I was a little bit concerned about going public in any degree, to any degree, using any form. I didn't even tell my family about my experiences. So I didn't know of a way to talk about my experiences. And now fast forward to the past, I guess, 4 or 5 years, and there's been this increasing progression to disclosure, or at least the appearance that disclosure by the U.S. government, for one, of the reality of the UFO alien phenomenon is at hand. I don't know if that's true, but it certainly appeared to be at some point, and I there's still a reasonable chance of that. Also, I'm at the point now where I'm more established in my career. I was, of course, very concerned about going public with this early in my career, and what effect it would have on how my grants were reviewed and what my colleagues thought of me. But at this point, I think it's so important on the threshold of disclosure. It's such a critically important issue for the human race. You know, I feel I'm willing to take the risks. There may be some adverse effects on my reputation, professional, personal reputation, et cetera. I knew I could write a book that would, since I could remember so many of the details of these experiences without, you know, the use of regressive hypnosis. I could write a book that would be really a unique contribution to ufology, in that I would be the first mainstream American scientist, at least, to come forward with his UFO close encounters and alien abduction experiences. And I thought I could make a contribution to the field and address a very critically important issue that we all need to address today. So that's essentially the reason why I wrote the book.
Before the 1980s, and before you got all that information about other people, did you have any theories about what had been happening to you? Did you feel maybe you're the only one?
No, it was strange. It's something I can't explain. I always had an interest in science, and from age of 10, 11, 12, I was fascinated with the U.S. space program, the lunar landing program, and shortly thereafter became interested in UFOs because they were in all, you know, in all the papers, and I began to read a lot of UFO literature, not so much about UFO abductions. That we really didn't hear too much about that until the 80s, but I never made the connection between contact with, you know, between human beings and UFOs or the beings that are piloting the UFOs and my own particular experiences. I thought there were simply strange paranormal experiences that I couldn't explain. You know, in the back of my mind, I was dimly aware in my young age that I had some type of encounters with something that transcended normal human experience, but I really didn't have a clue what those strange, quote unquote, paranormal experiences meant until I began to read the UFO abduction literature. And to tell you the truth, these what I call paranormal, in retrospect, paranormal experiences made such an impression on me that I was very easy to write them down in a book. I remembered a lot of the details. Interestingly enough, reading the literature did not change my view, my perspective in terms of what details I could remember, or it didn't color the different aspects of the experiences that I could recall. Didn't really change my overall recall of these experiences. They were ingrained in my memory because from time to time throughout my early life, I would think about them and retrieve the memory and, you know, you not be able to answer the question that I asked myself over and over, what did they mean? But they were at the forefront of my consciousness a lot of the time. I certainly didn't make the connection, didn't connect the dots until, you know, the groundbreaking UFO abduction, alien abduction investigators began to interview thousands of witnesses and draw their own conclusions that I thought were fairly drawn from experiences that were replicated very tightly from witness to witness to witness. And I realized I was one of them that fit that pattern.
I wanted to talk to you about the experience you had in 1965 when you saw a UFO with some friends. I got a whole ton of questions about that because it seemed, when you go into it in detail, there were lots of things that happened that are typical of UFO encounters.
Yes.
But could you just, you know, tell us what happened?
Well, it was a couple days before the beginning of summer, beautiful, cloudless day, June 19th, 1965. We were playing a game of kickball in the front yard of our home in the suburbs just outside of New Haven, Connecticut. And four people per team, and I was playing defense near the end of our property, right at the edge of the driveway of our home. For some reason, I looked to my right and I saw an immensely brilliant light. Now, I really couldn't get a good glimpse of it because there was a large oak tree in the center of our front yard that was blocking the view. So I walked directly toward our house, and then I can see in the western sky and get a completely unobstructed view of what I describe as a UFO that is a brilliantly lit white light that has the configuration of the biblical Star of Bethlehem, but not a distant point source of light like that from an airplane or helicopter or star or planet. This was 2.5 times the size of the full moon, and it was silent, just hanging there motionless in the sky. As I continued watching it, I began to observe something very strange that I've never observed before. The environment seemed to alter. It was as if time was going down. I didn't hear any of the ambient noises from the neighborhood, the animals, the insects particularly the insects, the noise from which can be deafening at that time of year. Suddenly, everything had shut off. I turned my head away because I thought I was distracted by this fascinating experience, looking at something, seeing something I'd never seen before in my life. So I turned my head away from it. Again, I couldn't hear anything. Been hearing insects. Everything was silent. What was alarming, though, was there was a fellow on my left, and I can't remember his name. I know he had, only thing I remember, he had blonde hair, and he looked to be motionless, frozen. This was frightening to me. So alarming that I looked away. I wish I hadn't seen this. And I then, for some reason, very abruptly, the light went off as if by a flip of a light switch. And in its place was what I would call a fireball, a red spherical shaped object that looked like a fireball, but it was probably the size of a dime held at arm's length. And I could see it began to move. And it was moving in a southeasterly direction, a course that was parallel to the surface of the Earth. It didn't change its direction, its speed, its altitude. And I watched it for about a minute and a half until it disappeared over the horizon. And I think at that point, I'd walked to a neighbor's yard to be able to watch it as it, again, as I say, disappeared over the horizon. Walked back to our property, to our front yard. And now with the other children in our group, began to discuss what we had just seen. And I think I'm going to break here, if you don't mind, because I think you might have some specific questions about this particular episode.
First of all, it's that thing of noticing that it's so quiet, like all the animals or the insects are just stopped making any sound. It's almost right. Like you've been kind of removed very slightly from our reality or our dimension or wherever it is we are. Or if there's some kind of bubble around you, how would you characterize it?
Well, I talk in the book about the term that Jacques Vallée, the famous French ufologist, used about close encounters of the fourth kind, where there's an altered sense of reality. It really felt like this, I'd stepped into another dimension. And of course, as a scientist, I'm wondering, what could account for this? Is this... something that the aliens are superimposing upon our consciousness through some neurological mechanism? You know, that's something I considered at length in the book. Or does it have to do with what I call a relativistic effect? If there's, you know, a technology that is having an alien technology that's generating a tremendous amount of some type of energy, electromagnetic energy, gravitational energy, that's maybe having a neurological effect on the human brain, or may be able to affect in a relativistic way our perception of the passage of time. I don't have any evidence to support one or more theories, but I know that this has been a phenomenon that has been very characteristic of the UFO abduction phenomenon. But again, I don't have any definitive answers as to what the origin of it is. And I don't know if any investigators that have examined this question deeply enough to really generate any insights that would help us understand it better.
You talked about how you looked around at your friend and they seemed to be frozen.
Yeah, it wasn't just one person. I wanted to say as well, and not only was there was no noise coming from the surrounding environment, the normal ambient noises you would hear at that time of day, but seven of the other players in this game, other than myself, were not talking, were not moving. I heard nothing from them as well, which leads me to believe that, you know, this may be attributable to a general effect of being in a UFO close encounter situation where there's some exposure to a source of energy that must have some psychological effect because it has some neurological effect on any animal species. This is, you know, simply my theory. I have no, you know, direct empirical evidence to prove or support that. But that's what my gut tells me is the best explanation. I was very concerned about the fact that my friends and classmates appeared to be frozen. They were no longer talking. But the strange thing was I seemed to be the only one who was dynamic in my behavior. And of course I could move anywhere. I could have talked, but I was silent because I was so focused on watching where this UFO was traveling to. But again, this is an aspect of the UFO abduction phenomenon that has been replicated countless times, at least in the literature that I've examined.
There's something I talk to my guests about regularly, which is this idea that UFOs could probably travel around our skies without lighting themselves up, but it was lit up. Do you think perhaps it did it on purpose so that you would see it?
That's an interesting idea. I haven't considered in detail in the book. I attribute that to the fact that, you know, we're looking at a technology that can perhaps allow the UFO to travel instantaneously from any point in space, point A to point B. It may be able to do that over a distance of 1,000 miles, 1,000,000 miles, or 1,000,000,000,000 miles. We don't know. The energy source for technology that could accomplish that type of interplanetary space travel, unless it's perfectly efficient, which is very unlikely, is likely to release a lot of energy as waste in the form of what I've theorized is plasma. There's an electromagnetic effect on the gases in the atmosphere that cause ionization of those gases, which leads them to release a lot of light. But what was startling to me to realize is that this object that was so silent and yet so brilliantly lit that it was almost difficult to look at, if that was only a fraction of the energy it was generating, it's quite impressive to contemplate how much energy was available for this technology. You know, as a scientist, these are the questions that nag me, and you know, how any civilization design and build a technology with that much energy, but would have to be able to do what we theorize these UFOs are capable of doing. But in terms of your idea is something that is a very interesting idea. They're trying to wake us up to their existence. It always seems that many abductees are saying they're here for me. They don't want anyone else to see them. And sometimes there are reports of people seeing UFOs and that it clearly must have been seen by many people, but there are no reports. It's almost as if only the abductee has seen the UFO, that it lit up and became apparent only to that person. But again, these are speculations that we can, you know, indulge in, you know, ad infinitum.
So afterwards, you got together with the other people and it was like people saw different things to each other or saw different things to what you saw?
Well, you know, other encounters, UFO close encounters, with or without an abduction, I recall investigators have raised this point about why sometimes if there's a multiple witness sighting, people don't all see the same thing. Now, there are multiple theories that would explain this. My theory is that in my case and in other cases, it's because there's an altered state of consciousness experienced by the abductee, experienced by the other witnesses that who may or may not be abducted. And it's possible that altered state of consciousness, which may be different for each of the witnesses, is accounting for why they're seeing different things. Secondly, the fact that there is an abduction in progress, that at least one of the witnesses may be not present on this at the scene of the close encounter, may account for why different witnesses appear to be seeing different things. That's the explanation for why I believe two or three critical features of this sighting that we had, of seeing an electrostatic discharge near the UFO, finding that it transformed into not one light, but three multicolored lights forming a triangular formation, was, I believe, due to the fact that at least one of the people in that group, certainly I would put myself in that category, was taken from that particular site location. And what supports that theory in this particular case, in my sighting and my theorized abduction, is the fact that one of the witnesses told me that for a period of time, I disappeared. I was not present at that location. So that's my explanation for why in this particular case, the different witnesses saw different aspects of this particular UFO. That may not be the best explanation for this particular epiphenomenon that has been reported for other UFO close encounters with likely UFO abductions associated with it, with them.
And also you say the first thought that occurred to me when you saw the light was that you thought to yourself, did they find me again? But as far as you were concerned, you'd never had any contact.
So strange for me to look back at that and realize that's exactly what occurred to me. And at the time, and even now, I didn't understand what prompted me to have that feeling, to speculate that this experience was targeting me, was intended for me. We know how prominent a feature of UFO abductions is the experience of missing time. And it's been talked about at length in by a number of investigators. And I know in my case, what I can recall may be a very small percentage of the total UFO abduction experiences I've had. But there's enough of it bleeding into my consciousness so that I'm dimly aware that I had made contact with something, some non-human intelligence. Again, only dimly aware of it. And at the age of 10 or 11 or 12, I didn't really know what the origin of that was. But I knew that there was something I had made contact with, but didn't really explore it at that time in my life. I didn't know how to, because there was no references that discuss any of the theories that were proposed, you know, decades later, that would have allowed me to get to the bottom of why I felt this way. But I certainly felt that, not that I was the center of attention, but something was. And the word I used in the book for one of the chapters is stalking me at that time. And I didn't know why. I think I know why now, but I didn't know that.
And there was another thing that happened to you. If you could tell us, you saw a UFO outside your bedroom window and you just turned your head and went to sleep, which was an odd thing to do.
The point you bring up is the point I bring up a number of times in the book, because what I want to say about the experience you just alluded to is that even today I'm startled that at the age where I was so fascinated by anything that was flying in the sky, airplane, jet, helicopter, natural, whether it's natural or artificial, it's very difficult for me to believe that I didn't get out of my bed, run down the stairs, run outside, and look at this strangest object I'd ever seen, strangest looking airplane, I call it, I'd ever seen, with a totally unexpected against electrostatic discharge, static discharge that I could see near the tail, what I thought was the tail part of the airplane, flying so low, just above the houses in our neighborhood, that it's startling to me today that I didn't do this, and instead, as if under command, turned my head away from the window for which I could see this UFO, turned my head in the other direction, and immediately go to sleep. This is what I describe in the book as another example of this control that the aliens, I'm theorizing, seem to have over the abductee, that it's as almost if there's no willpower or loss of willpower to challenge, to go against, to even question what is happening to the abductee. Again, this was a fascinating thing to me to contemplate, because I wondered what could be the reason for this. Was there some type of technology the aliens were using to control the abductees that we can understand? I theorize that the technology may involve an implant. There's been a lot of talk of implants and what their function might be. Could they be tracking devices? Could they be devices used to study human beings? And one theory I propose is that, in addition, another function could be to control the abductee. And there may be a technology that is at the heart of the implant that may be employed remotely on people that aren't abductees. And this was a significant interest and one of the major things I focused on in the book.
It's a thing where they may have control over the experiencer, but they also have control over people around them. Because you talk about how one day your father slowly dropped to the floor and you thought it was a joke.
This is a very common phenomenon in the UFO alien abductions. I was just walking in our apartment. It was early in the morning and everyone was awake except for my mother. And I just happened to see him. I thought he was collapsing. I didn't know what was happening. But again, he was gently, slowly turning 45 degrees with his eyes closed now, almost pirouetting and slowly coming down to the floor. Touched the floor first, then his shoulder, turned over on his back. And I couldn't arouse him. I tried to slap his face, either side of his face. His eyes were open and fixed, and I couldn't arouse him. And I went to my mother's bedroom because my brother actually happened to see this. And he said, you know, the same thing happened to mom, and went to her bedroom and our parents' bedroom, and again, tried the same thing. My mother was sleeping. It looked like she was sleeping peacefully, but I tried to rouse her as well. Grabbed her by both shoulders and shook her. Her head fell back on the pillow. And my mother, who was a very light sleeper normally, could not be aroused. And the strange thing about this incident was that, again, I should have done more to call one of the neighbors or try to arouse them, do something more to try to wake up my parents. But I seemed to retreat into the apartment, walk out of my mother's bedroom, our parents' bedroom. And at that point, I experienced a missing time. I didn't know what happened after that. I thought I was strange that I was almost induced to retreat from this scene where both of my parents fainted or become unconscious. And the next thing I knew, and this was a matter of a second or two, I was back in the apartment in the hallway, same hallway where I'd first seen my father collapse to the floor. But now at this point, everyone, my brother, my mother, my father, were walking around doing what they normally would do early on a Sunday morning, if it was the weekend, which I think it was, as if we were, this was near the end of December. It was as if we were preparing to accept guests for Christmas dinner. So again, this is a number example of the control, not just over the abductee, where the abductee is taken, his memory is erased, and as a result has this experience of missing time, where there's a period of time that lapses where the abductee doesn't know what happened to him. But the people around him seem to be under also some type of control. And it's called in the UFO phenomenon, the switching off part of the abduction phenomenon, and where the abductee could be at home, taken from their bedroom. If their wife or husband is in bed with them, they seem to be paralyzed or they're not responding even after the abductee sees the aliens in the room before the abduction takes place. They're not able to arouse their partner. The abductee could be driving in a car with his family, and the car pulls over to the side of the road. There's an approach of a UFO. There's a close encounter. They usually see alien beings. But the abductee, again, is very aware of the fact that his fellow passengers are, again, switched off. They're unresponsive, and they seem to be under some type of control. Again, I talk at length about the implants and whether or not that one of their functions could be this control mechanism. And also the fact that the underlying technology or something similar to that may be used to prevent other witnesses that aren't part of the abduction from interfering in any way with the abduction.
I wanted to talk to you about the ETs that you've encountered. I don't know if some people call them visitors, some people call them aliens, ETs. I'm not sure what you prefer.
A visitor is as good as any other word, but we don't know if they're extraterrestrials or interdimensionals. I know they're not human, so I've chosen the term alien. So that's the term I've used in the book most often.
So what I wanted to ask you about was this time where you were young and you woke up on this table and you got up on your elbows and you looked up through this big doorway and there were these ETs there walking backwards and forwards.
Well, that's the time. You already introduced the first part of this episode where I was in bed looking at this strange-looking airplane. It was near dusk, maybe 7:30 in the middle. And I would say early July or late June. And I can see this UFO flying strangely so low over the rooftops of the houses in our neighborhood, and then turned away, ignored it, went to sleep. And when I woke up, I was on a table, a very large table. It certainly was too large to be a table to accommodate a child, a six-year-old child. I was six at the time. And I knew I wasn't in my bedroom anymore. It looked like it was a hospital environment. And I surmised that because I was on what I thought was some type of examination table. And I sensed some motion in front of me, in front of the foot of the table. And this induced me to sit up. And when I did, I would say about 20 feet away, I could see literally dozens of diminutive humanoid beings that were white in color. I don't know if they were being lit by some bright light, the source of which I couldn't see, or if that was their natural color. But they all looked uniform. They looked like they were clones of one particular alien, all the same height, 3.5-4 feet tall. No, certainly no taller than I was at that age. Had disproportionately large hairless heads, but they were walking seemingly down a hallway in either direction. They were almost like columns, some walking from left to right, some walking from right to left. I wasn't sure if not they were on some type of motorized walkway like you would see at an airport. But I was startled at the fact that there were dozens of them. Could only get a side view of them, so I couldn't make out much detail of their facial features. But again, they fit the classic mold of the 3.5 to 4 foot tall gray alien, although their color wasn't gray at that particular time. Now, for some reason, because they're so identical and in their appearance, and they seem to be very busy walking very quickly back and forth with what I thought was intense seriousness of purpose. And other investigators have said that this type of behavior is evocative of what we would call a hive mind. They're almost what you would think would be under some type of control by an artificial intelligence. But for some reason, another question came to my mind at that time: were there both sexes represented? Were there? I thought in my childish mind, are there boys and girls? I thought they were doctors, but they were the strangest looking doctors I'd seen. For some reason, I was wondering whether only boys or only girls there. And I seemed to, after posing that question to myself, I seemed to be made to understand that, yes, in fact, both sexes were represented. I never knew how I came to that conclusion. I was able to obtain that information. And it really appeared that someone was eavesdropping on my internal dialogue and answered that question for me, because there was no way these beings all looked so identical to one another. There was no way I would know to anything anywhere near a moral certainty the answer to that question. Now, at that point, I guess the powers that be in that area didn't want to entertain any more questions from me, or didn't want me to see any more of what was transpiring in front of me. Because I felt a force that was gentle but firm on my chest. It was as if, and I can't be sure about this, but it was as if a hand that was as large as my, that would cover my abdomen and chest, was gently pushing me back down on the table. I don't know if that was exactly what was happening, or whether or not, again, I was under some type of neurological control that was causing me to lie down. And then after I laid back on the table again, I went to sleep, woke up the next morning. I didn't remember anything that happened after that.
With these aliens, like you say, they seemed almost like clones. They're very industrious, because there's this idea that if they had evolved on another planet or in another dimension, how could they survive on our planet so easily? We're breathing our air and our gravity's just fine for them. It's almost like the aliens that you've interacted with were genetically engineered to be okay on Earth.
Simon, that's my theory. I mean, other investigators have kind of mentioned this theory that, you know, and I really have greatly influenced my opinion by Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso, who wrote The Day After Roswell, who said he was part of a program working with Army intelligence in the 40s that had access to some of the artifacts from the crash UFOs that were obtained at Roswell, from Roswell, New Mexico. And in addition, had access to the autopsy reports on the aliens that died at that crash and were examined by, and this is his claim, pathologists at Walter Reed Hospital in 1947. And, you know, he claims that the pathologists concluded that they were really struck by the conclusion that the aliens were different from human beings, but they were very similar, remarkably similar in some respects. But as I write in one of my chapters in the afterword, at the end of my book, Dominion Lost, there's a lot of evidence, and Philip Corso has alluded to this possibility, but I see a lot of evidence that these beings, these 3.5 foot tall humanoid beings that are short in stature, have disproportionately large heads, but share a lot of similarities anatomically and physiologically with human beings, were actually genetically engineered from one of our early hominin ancestors that happened to be the same height And the species, the name of the species was Homo habilis, which was thought to be 3.5 to 4 feet in height. And one of the remarkable findings of the pathologist at Walter Reed Hospital, after the autopsies of the aliens that died at Roswell, one of the conclusions in that report is that those alien beings, whether they're genetically engineered from hominins or from some other species, were engineered for space travel. They had, for their size, unusually large lungs, for their size, an unusually large high heart, a usually large filling chamber in the heart that I theorize would make them better able to withstand the hazards of space travel. And actually, you know, that was one of the conclusions, although they didn't elaborate the physiological basis for the conclusion. They didn't really describe enough medical facts that they drew their conclusions from. But the pathologist did theorize that that was one of the reasons why the physiology, particularly the physiology of the heart and lungs, was so different from that of human beings, because they were designed for space, because those beings were designed for space travel. And interestingly enough, 20 or 30 years or more after those, if you believe what Philip Corso has written about, after those aliens had been autopsied, there were studies in the scientific literature, you know, strongly suggesting that that's exactly how a humanoid or human being would benefit if they were genetically engineered to be able to tolerate some of the adverse effects of space travel. And these studies went into length as to how the effects of low gravity would cause certain what's called shifts in fluid from the core of the body up to the brain, which would cause a lot of neurological effects that could be avoided if the space traveler was genetically engineered the way the Roswell aliens were genetically engineered. And I go into great detail, in my book about why it's scientifically very plausible that that's the reason why the physiology of the Roswell aliens is distinctly different from that of human beings.
And that analysis kind of makes them sound like they're just flesh and bone like us. But at the same time, they do much more peculiar things than we can do, like telepathy. But also, you talk about a time when you woke up and there was a semi-transparent alien in your room.
This is consistent. That particular experience is consistent with the other experiences I've had where I woke up on a table in some type of a hospital setting where, again, this alien beings that were humanoid, but of the same height, 3.5 to 4 feet tall, with unusually large hairless heads. And I've also had experiences of where I'm dreaming and I'm flying under my own power. And I can see these same beings on either side of me. But the one instance you're referring to, this one particular experience I had a little bit later in life when I was, I believe, early teens, is that I woke up, but I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. I could not even move my head, but my head happened to be, you know, leaning right where I could look and see this lamp that was, this table lamp was on the right side of my bed. And in that same area where the lamp was, I could see this silhouette, gray silhouette of a being that was crouching over me. And interestingly enough, when I measured the head of the lamp, the being's head was barely higher than the head, the light fixture part of this table lamp. I measured it. It was 3.5 feet tall. So again, this is this alien's appearance. It's at least external anatomy was consistent with all the other experiences I and thousands of other abductees have had. I'll talk about the most concerning part of this particular episode, this particular encounter, which I believe was, again, another abduction, was the fact that although I couldn't move, I could see this being, at least a silhouette of this being, but I couldn't see its hands. And it appeared that the hands were on either side of my head. Again, I speculated in the book as to whether or not was this a implantation procedure or a procedure where an implant that I received that was being removed, or was this the end of an abduction event where I'd been returned to my bedroom and the alien was just putting my body and gently putting my head to rest on my pillow. But I go over all the possibilities as to what had been transpiring prior to the time that I abruptly saw this alien being, like the alien beings I'd seen before, crouching over me.
And with the implants, you talk about a lot of it in the book. It's so interesting. But there's nosebleeds associated with this, isn't there? And there's a time you say, was it that you were walking in the hallway or you just woke up in your hallway with a nosebleed? And then you heard your parents coming, entering the building.
Again, I'll just say before I forget, another example of control. But I'll explain why it's a little bit different this time. In this instance, the other feature of classic feature of alien abduction is present as well. Sense of missing time. I couldn't, at that moment, for the life of me, tell what I'd been doing that day. I couldn't remember what had happened before that experience began of having this nosebleed. I didn't know what I'd done that day before that happened. All I knew is I was standing in the hallway with my back against one wall, facing another wall, and had this feeling of moistness under each nostril. Now, I had never had a nosebleed before. I didn't know what was happening to me. I heard a voice in my head tell me what was happening. I knew it wasn't my own voice. I can't explain how I know that, but I knew it was my own voice. I didn't hear then, or any other time afterward, voices in my head, but voice was telling me, don't let them see the blood. Interesting, because at that very moment, I could hear someone walking up my stairs. It's my mother and my brother. I don't know where they were coming from. They were going shopping downtown, but it was logical that I would be instructed to remove the evidence, the blood on my face. I didn't even know I was bleeding. That's another thing. I don't know how that could have been my internal dialogue telling me to remove the blood when I didn't know that I was bleeding. I very quickly didn't ignore this almost telepathic command to remove the blood. I walked a few steps to the bathroom. I was horrified to see I was bleeding from both nostrils. Blood was running down my cheeks and reaching my chin. I immediately washed it off. I still don't understand why I had to do that so quickly, under such duress, almost under command. You know, this is an example of, I guess, a subject that we're gonna get into where this is a common experience. A lot of alien abductees had this unexplained nosebleed. I, as I described in the book, I had no medical issues, no issues of flu-like symptoms or cold or sinusitis or any type of medical issue at all that would cause, or no trauma. I hadn't fallen down. Nothing that would cause me to have a spontaneous nosebleed, as many abductees report. they also have what in their minds are nosebleeds without context, without cause, without any explanation. And it's interesting that many of these abductees can recall these events, these strange nosebleeds consciously, but then also experience missing time during the episode of the nosebleed. Somehow they have some sense of missing time. And as I did, although I haven't done this, abductees who have this experience of missing time, strange unexplained nosebleed, have a curiosity and seek out the advice of an abduction investigator. And when they have regressive hypnosis, then uncover the abduction event, where they can recall being on a table and having an implant inserted somewhere in their head, whether it's inside the ear, near the ear, in an eye socket, very commonly in the nasal cavity. And they can sometimes see the implant being placed inside the nasal cavity, for example, or removed. And so this is, again, I should stress that the nosebleed in the abduction literature is in almost every case consciously recalled. And this is evidence of a physically invasive, what I call pseudo-medical procedure that causes trauma. And that is the cause of the nosebleed. And when they have the regressive hypnosis, that reveals the procedure that is the source of the trauma that has led to the nosebleed. So it's all forms a logically coherent pattern of, and I should add that some of the abductees, in addition, have under examination by a physician also been told that they have strange unexplained scars in the back of the throat behind the nasal cavity, You know, it goes along, forms a logical narrative with the nosebleed and the memory of being on a table and undergoing some type of an experimental procedure at the hands of a short alien humanoid being. And so, you know, I can recall in my case the nosebleed, having this implant at some point, the same year, I can recall having this implant introduced into the nasal cavity, my nasal cavity. And in addition, you know, I can also recall a physician, because I had an operation within a few months of having these experiences. I had an operation, an operation by an ear, nose, and throat surgeon to remove my adenoids and tonsils, who has been reported in the literature, the abduction literature, discovered a scar or hole, either again in my nasal cavity or in the nasal pharynx. This was amazing to me because I've seen reports in the literature that other abductees have had the same exact set of experiences at the same age of 6 years old that I had. So it's startling to find these parallels between my experiences and what has been reported in the literature, and which is one of the major reasons why I feel that no other model best explains my experiences other than the alien abduction model.
So we've run out of time.
Oh, really? Okay. Wow.
We were talking about your book. It's called Dominion Lost, A Scientist's Own Alien Abduction Encounters. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yes, absolutely. And you could get it. You can get it on Amazon UK or Amazon. You know, the only thing is, if you want to get if you're in the UK, for example, and you want to order the Kindle version so you can read it as an ebook, I think you can only get it in the American on Amazon.com and not on Amazon. UK.com, I believe.
Right. Okay. Do you have a website?
No, actually, I have a you know, Facebook page, and you know, my Amazon book page has a lot of details about the book, and you know, so there's a lot that can be gleaned from either my Facebook page or my Amazon book page.
Great. And well, thanks again for coming on the podcast.
And I want to thank you again for inviting me, and look forward to, you know, seeing if there's any feedback from the people who listen to your podcast in the future. And they can, of course, if they have any questions, email me at my email is in on the copyright page in my book, dominionlost@gmail.com.
Well, that's easy to remember. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Simon.
And that was an interview with Bruce Rapalano about his book, Dominion Lost, A Scientist's Own Alien Abduction Encounters. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can hear the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Our Paranormal Afterlife, and there are over 300 episodes. On Our Paranormal Afterlife, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of Our Paranormal Afterlife every Thursday, and that's called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. In my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which could be booked on my website. My Instagram is rparanormalafterlife with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. Is this still ongoing? Have you had encounters recently, or has it kind of stopped at a certain age?
Well, Simon, I'm one of the individuals that, for one reason or another, and there's